two main factors with renovation right now or development is, you mentioned it earlier, resources, so subs, contractors, and materials. Delays due to materials. So we look to whatever we can to shorten the window on those types of things. For instance, we're buying almost a lot of our renovations, we're buying our materials up front. You know, if we know over the next year we're going to turn 32 units, we're buying 32 units worth of materials today. We're having a container dropped on the back of the property with a padlock on it, and we're putting our materials in that container.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jim Vest has 15 years in real estate investing and development, from partnering with developers to develop raw land to purchasing and investing in single family rentals, fix and flips, and multifamily. He currently owns over $100 million in real estate assets. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sam. Great to be here.
Hey, man, pleasure's mine. Same three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show in 90 seconds or less. Can you tell us, where did you start? Where are you now, and how did you get there?
Yeah, sure. Let's see. Where did I start? 90 seconds or left. I started in 2006 doing land development. Met a couple of guys in the IT industry that were already doing that. They piqued my real estate interest and started buying raw land, getting it ready for developers. Moved over into fix and flips shortly after 2010, after coming out of 2008. Everybody knows what happened then. Got into fix and flips, single family, and then pivoted into multifamily shortly after 2018. That's where I am today. And how did I get there? Just, you know, strong networking and lots of good coaches and mentors, man. Those have made all the difference in the world, to be honest.
That's intriguing. So it's fun to talk to people with a background in development. Do you see more opportunity in the development side today, maybe even than you did in 2006?
Yeah. Oddly enough, I think people were kind of, I hate to say it this way, but kind of manufacturing the demand for, you know, development back in 2006. You know, what's the old saying, you know, when you see somebody who's got a $10 an hour job and they own three homes, that kind of thing. You know, it was real easy to procure a loan back then. So, you know, here we are today, and there is a legitimate demand for housing in this country. There is a big shortage, a major shortage. And so, yeah, there's a ton of development opportunity. I still have a lot of good connections in the land space. I got some buddies running a really strong land fund. And, you know, the word I'm hearing from them right now is they have small builders all the way up to the big national builders calling and say, if you got land, I want it. That's just point blank. You got land, I want it. And so, yeah, there's a lot of opportunity right now for development, for sure.
Is that, and you guys are strictly, you know, you said in 2018, you moved into multifamily. I mean, some of the things that we've heard from around the country are that now it's even cheaper just to build ground up than it is to go buy, you know, older vintage stock. What does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, if you can get the land and it makes sense, then yeah, it's absolutely, you know, I know a guy who just took, I want to say 150 some acres and, you know, went through the rezoning process, and now, you know, they're going for it, and they're definitely paying less per unit than I am for existing, you know, so there's definitely opportunity there. My partners and I, we have some land that came with us, a purchase that we did late last year, and we're probably going to be kicking off a development on that this year as well. And we will end up coming in cheaper per door on development than some of the existing stuff we're purchasing.
Right. Which is kind of crazy because, I mean, lumber prices, raw material prices are so high that it's kind of mind-boggling that you can still get into these deals all done for less than you could buying something maybe that's 20 years old.
Yeah, man, the demand for existing, you know, it's just absolutely crazy. You know, if you're not going direct to seller, and even if you are, there's, you know, multiple offers on it. Even some of my broker connections where it's just me and three other guys, you know, you imagine something that's on the market that everybody can see. I mean, they're getting 10, 15, 20 offers on something. They're just bidding each other up. And, you know, a lot of that's going on. The money's so cheap. And then on top of that, you know, we're seeing a lot of guys who are doing syndications. Sometimes it's hard to syndicate a new development because there's no cash flow for 2 years. So, you know, if you don't have an investor base that's looking strictly for an equity play, you know, it's hard. It's tough to do ground up development. It all comes down to like what your investor network looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what do you think what the Fed does in March, how does that affect all of this demand, supply, inflation? Like, what's this all look like to you, and how are you guys preparing for it?
Yeah. So we can only go off what they're telling us they're going to do, right? Because March isn't here yet. But
right.
If we take them at their word, they're going to raise rates at least half a point. You know, we're hearing from some of our lending partners that they're planning on 0.75 points. So we'll see. What are we doing to prepare for it? You know, quite honestly, we were kind of preparing for it 12 months ago in our underwriting for anything that we purchased last year that had a refi event in, say, the next 2 years. We were underwriting those refis at the 5.5% rate. And, you know, I hope that doesn't come true. I'd love to see those come back in at more like 4.5, but I don't know that we will 24 months from now. So one of the ways we're preparing for it is we're underwriting even more conservatively on things we're looking at right now. Quite frankly, we're trying to do less refis in, you know, 2 years. And we're trying to talk to our investors about that. It's like, guys, I get it. Everybody wants their initial capital back, but there's also something to be said for locking in at 4.5% and just letting the market increase our cash flow every year. So that, you know, we're talking to our investors about that. And then the other thing we're doing to prepare is we're even going back to some of the stuff we already own and saying, hey, I know we underwrote it at 5.5 on a refi, but let's make sure we are prepared for even worse case. And let's go back and see what it looks like at 6, 6.5. And if we don't hit it, great, but let's just be prepared, right?
And what do you do with that information when you look at that? Because you know you own the deal, you got your investors already in it. We underwrote it now, not at 5.5, but now we're at 6.5. What's your action item once you do that analysis?
Couple of things, you know, are there ways to, you know, even though you're underwriting into that, are there ways to more aggressively go after expenses and rent bumps? You know, we were going to be a little more conservative on rent bumps, you know, to try to keep the vacancies low, but maybe, you know, let's figure out, you know, instead of going after 1250, let's see what 1275, 1300 looks like. You know, can we get there with that? Can we get there with less renovation? Right. Or do we just need to go ahead and suck it up and put the money into it and go for a much higher level renovation? You know, we're looking at those different things. And then one of the other things we're looking at is, hey, if we only have to pull out 65 versus 70%, you know, on the refi, you know what I mean? Keep 65 versus 70% in on the refi. You know, we're looking at stuff like that. And then one of the biggest places we're starting to look is, hey, if we were in a bridge product and we were expecting 24 months on this bridge, you know, what if we go in and we more aggressively go after the renovations and we try to cut our renovation timeline from 24 months to 14 and let's refi 14 months versus 24 months. So we're looking at all those different pieces.
Yeah, I would imagine if you can truncate your renovation timeline, obviously going to cost you more money up front in the sense that you may renovate units either that aren't leased or that you just have to put that CapEx budget to work sooner.
Yeah. But
then what you're predicting is that maybe your bet is that interest rates, I'm asking for correction if I get this wrong, that if interest rates rise, then you can lock in a refi sooner than later.
Absolutely. Yep. You're 100%. So let's go ahead and refi it. Even if you have to do something like, hey, we were projecting 80% of your capital back in 24 months. Hey, look, this is the market. This is what the rates look like. So we're going to go ahead and get you 70% in 14 months, but we're also going to make sure we lock in at potentially a full point lower than if we waited another 12. So, you know, it's not the ideal scenario, but it is a very strong scenario. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, we always go into things with multiple exit strategies, right? And this is one of those exit strategies.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I don't know any investor who would fuss if you gave them 70% of their capital back and like, oh, but we're saving a whole point on interest. Potential.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and then you just show them what those returns look like. Like, they, you know, we're going to be able to keep the cash on cash stronger for you. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what, quite frankly, that's what a lot of our investors are looking at. Like the equity is almost secondary to them over the cash flow.
Right.
Because like I've mentioned earlier, I don't have a ton of investors who want just equity. You know, they want things that cash flow within 6 months. And that's one of the reasons why we don't do more ground up development is we just haven't built a network that's kind of leaning towards that. So
that is really, really intriguing. How much of your portfolio has bridge debt on it? And what are you doing to offset the risk?
Yeah, currently right now we have two properties that we own that have bridge debt. And those were medium to heavy value add properties. And that's the reason we did bridge on those. And then quite frankly, on at least one of those, I think we're going to be able to accelerate the renovation timeline. I think we're going to be able to cut at least 8 months out of it. You know, it'll take a little more handholding because instead of just waiting for leases to run out, we're going to be actively working with the tenants to move them in, you know, around the property. Instead of saying, your lease is up, you know, I know you want to move on. We're going to say, hey, there's a renovated unit across the parking lot. Let's move you over there. Let's get access to your unit, you know.
How do you have those conversations with tenants? Because from my standpoint or vantage point, moving stinks. Nobody,
I don't like to move.
How do you coax a tenant to move across the street?
I don't know, because I don't like it. I'll be honest. I've been in my house for 16 years now. Boy, that day I move is going to be painful. I think I'm just going to open the door and tell my neighbors, take whatever you want. But yeah, moving does stink. You kind of got to make it worth their while. You know, hey, I'm going to give you a renovated unit. You're paying $1,150 today, $1,175 for something brand new, basically, you know, something like that. Or, you know, you got folks who, you know, they just want something a little bit nicer, work with them on that. Or quite frankly, you know, we have a number of tenants that are kind of saying, you know, I don't want the rent raise at all. So, you know, if you got an opportunity to let me move on, you know, we can do that as well. And quite frankly, that's not typically a problem for us on any of our properties, because I mean, we got a waiting list almost on everything we have, because there is a shortage of housing in this country. And if you have high vacancies on properties, there's usually a warning sign there right now.
That's really, really intriguing. What are some ways on shortening the renovation process? How are you doing that?
So a couple of things, and this is one of the things our lenders don't like right now. One of the biggest issues, two main factors with renovation right now or development is, you mentioned it earlier, resources. So subs, contractors, and materials. Delays due to materials. So we look to whatever we can to shorten the window on those types of things. For instance, we're buying almost a lot of our renovations, we're buying our materials up front. You know, if we know over the next year we're going to turn 32 units, we're buying 32 units worth of materials today. We're having a container dropped on the back of the property with a padlock on it, and we're putting our materials in that container so that when, you know, when that unit's ready, we don't have a 4, 6, 8 week delay waiting on countertops or cabinets or whatever. It's a little more money up front, but, you know, our contractors, our subs seem to like it because they know that when we're ready for them, that the stuff they need to do their job is going to be waiting on them sitting there. So that addresses the second piece, which is when our subs come to work for us, they know that they can show up, get the job done, and move on. They're not going to be doing something today, then they got to wait a week on a countertop, put those in, then they got to wait 2 weeks on toilets, you know, you name it. They can show up, everything's there, they can knock it out in a week.
That's really, really intriguing. I love that planning. Why do you say that your lenders don't like that?
Because our lenders don't like to pay for all the materials upfront. So if you're dealing with like a construction loan, they don't tend to like for you to go pay for all your materials and have them sitting on the site. Because let's be honest, like having materials sitting on a site does introduce some risk. It introduces a risk that those materials walk off.
Right.
As a lender, and I completely understand it, as a lender, you don't want that. But you don't like it when materials go missing. So, you know, we get that. But we try to work with them. We try to show them the things that we're doing to kind of protect those. Even to the extent with one of our lenders, we said, hey, you know what? Here's the padlocks we're doing. We're going to have a third party checking these things in and out. And we're putting cameras on the property. We'll put cameras on the property that are focused strictly at the containers. And we'll be able to keep an eye on everything, as well as, you know, we'll have a third party on site there that's checking materials in and out. When a sub wants a countertop, that it gets checked in and out, right? So, you know, we're just doing some things there to help the lenders kind of allay their fears a little bit, if you will.
I love the third party idea. I mean, just in case somebody's listening to this and goes, that's a really great idea, but I have no idea how to implement that.
We tend to leverage our property managers for that. We get our property managers to kind of keep an eye on the materials, and we will do regular checks, right? You said that you took two cabinets out this month, you know, check them off, and then we'll do an inventory at some point, reconcile what's actually still sitting in the container.
Right. Yeah. Because having been in the trades myself for the first third of my life, maybe, I can tell you, and having had 30 some odd employees in the trades, that stuff walks, even if they're your in-house employees, and you're like, hey, wait, where is that? And you go to find it a month later, you're like, okay, this is not going as planned. So yeah, that's a really interesting way to handle that.
Yeah. And even to your point, stuff walks, installed stuff walks too.
Right.
That's a conversation we had with a lender recently. He's like, but you know, it's just sitting there, you know, until it's installed. And I'm like, I've had HVACs walk off a property after they were installed. I mean, it's never 100% bulletproof, right? And there's a reason insurance companies don't like to insure vacant properties, right? So, you know, I mean, things walk. So yeah. you just got to do what you can to mitigate that risk, but you got to understand it's going to happen. You do it long enough, it's going to happen.
Oh, for sure. And that's just the way, you know, the cost of doing business. At some point, you can't prevent it entirely. You can mitigate it as much as you can, but you can't prevent it entirely. Tim, this has been fascinating. Thanks for taking the time today to break down kind of your business, what you guys do, how you do it. We didn't even get into really the conversation that I wanted to have with you about what you guys are buying and where, but maybe we'll save that for another day. Right now, let's jump here into, we'll do the last three questions here today. The first one for you is this: what is one mistake you could help our listeners avoid, and how would you avoid it?
Yeah, I'll go back to 2006. I wish I would have gotten a mentor back in 2006. I just jumped in with my IT buddies and we started buying land. They'd been doing it. They knew what they were doing. So we jumped in. But hey, if I'd had a mentor back then, maybe he would have looked at me and said, you know, some of that money you're making, you ought to stick it back and wait for a rainy day instead of just reinvesting it and buying more dollar for dollar. Because quite frankly, when 2008 happened, I didn't have any dry powder sitting on the sidelines and everything was invested. So that would be the biggest mistake that I made that I would say I'd go back and change is I will always have a mentor from this point forward. Always.
Right. That's brilliant. I love that. Next question for you. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Oh boy. What's one thing I'm doing right now to make a world a better place? I got to say, one of the places that we're trying to give back, we're actually trying to do it locally here. I have a little bit of an interest in youth soccer. So when we make some money, we try to give back and we try to help. Soccer can be an expensive sport. We try to help kids who can't afford soccer that want to play soccer. We try to help them play.
Man, that's cool. I love that. Tim, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, sure. So I'm always on LinkedIn. Just look me up, Tim L. Vest on LinkedIn, or you can hit me up at my email, tvest@harvestpg.com. So that's harvest, P as in Paul, G as in George.com.
Tim, thank you for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Take care, buddy.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.